In the first half of our show, we heard from Palestinian lawyer and writer Raja Shahadeh. My next guest, David Horovitz, is the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He also writes a column for the magazine. Horovitz has lived in Israel since emigrating from England in 1983. He's the author of the book A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel. His next book, Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror, will be published in March. We recorded our interview this morning. He spoke from a studio in Jerusalem. He told me that in Israel, fear of suicide bombings is profound and unrelenting. I asked him if there are places where Israelis feel most safe or most vulnerable.
Well, that's the awfulness. There is nowhere in Israel that is off limits to terrorism. I've been to funerals where there are security guards. Hospitals now, in the wake of a suicide bombing, have to upgrade their own security because of the concern that somebody may seek to profit from the chaos and blow up the hospitals. For me, the key proof that there was nowhere left that was a haven was the bombing a little over a year ago at the Hebrew University campus on Mount Scopus, for which I have a true fond connection because it happens to be where I met my wife. There was always an assumption that nobody would blow up Hebrew U because there are thousands of Arabs on the campus. And then last July, somebody blew it up. We become almost domestic security analysts. My wife and I have had very earnest and not particularly emotional conversations about things as banal as where to do the shopping. You know, which is safer this week? Should we go to the grocery store on the corner where there's no security guard, but it's unlikely that it would be targeted because there are not that many people there at any one time, but of course things like that have been targeted. Should we go to the supermarket where there is a guard, but of course the guard, if he does his job, may not be able to prevent the bombing. He may just be killed by the bomber, and that's happened, and it's happened in Jerusalem. Or in our case, we can go to Malha, which is this great big shopping mall in southern Jerusalem, where security is like, it's like airport security. You know, I'm fairly blonde, but I'm the least blonde member of my family, and we all look like sort of recent arrivals from Sweden. And yet when we pull up at Malha, we'll still get the third degree, and they'll check the trunk of the car, and you know all the things that I've forgotten to take out that are inexplicable and bizarre get sort of raked over, and that's just to get into the parking lot. And then you get to the entrance to the mall itself, and it's, you know, it's a metal detector gate and a guard with a detector stick, you know, to make sure you haven't got explosives under your clothes. And therefore, when you get into Malha, you think, you know, you sort of heave this sigh of relief and think, okay, here I'll be safe. But of course, because it's closed in and because it's crowded, if a bomber did get into Malha, the devastation would be all the more atrocious. And you really do. You have quite calm conversations about, well, okay, where is it better to buy our cornflakes and milk this week? Where is the least likely place to get blown up?
Have the suicide bombers affected your overall feelings about the Palestinian people? Or do you feel like you can contain your anger at the suicide bombers to the bombers themselves?
Well, I can only relate to the Palestinian people by the criteria that opinion polls and surveys provide for me. So I would love to be able to say that, you know, of course I recognize that it's only a small minority of Palestinians who are carrying out suicide bombings, which is, of course, the case, only a small minority. I mean, 100-plus, quote-unquote, successful bombings in 3 years is a fairly devastating minority, but it's a minority. And yet, troublingly, of course, survey after survey after survey shows that most Palestinians are saying they support the suicide bombers. So that, of course, has to filter into my conception of the Palestinian people. At the same time, I'm very aware that, in my opinion, this is a nation, a people who have been horrifically misled by their leadership. I mean, this is a leadership that came back from a very serious effort by an Israeli government 3 years ago to make peace and told its people, the Palestinian leadership told its people, that the Israelis didn't want to make peace. In other words, to my understanding of how things panned out here, the leaders lied to their people, told them that the Israelis never wanted to partner them towards independence, never were prepared to relinquish territory, never wanted viable terms for peace, all of which I think is a gross and malicious misportrayal of what happened at Camp David. And then on top of that, I know too, they have endured 3 years of hell. You know, as we've tried to stop the bombers, well, we've stopped them working inside Israel, and we've put up roadblocks and curfews and closures and all the things that we've done to try and keep ourselves safe, and that has affected ordinary people. So I understand, you know, I think there is a fair amount of hostility to Israel. I think it's manipulated hostility. I think it's hostility that could have been avoided, and I know that 3 years ago it wasn't there.
The Sharon government's policy toward Arafat right now is a policy of removal. Sharon has said the policy is not for assassination, it's for removal. What exactly does that mean in your understanding?
Well, first of all, I don't know. And I don't know because the Israeli government doesn't want me to understand, and quite possibly because they don't know what they're planning to do either. You're right that as of a few weeks ago, there was a Sharon was on an official visit to India, and there were two suicide bombings within just a few hours of each other, one of them not far from where I live in Jerusalem, and one in Ramleh, not far from Tel Aviv. Sharon dashed back from this official trip and passed a resolution in the cabinet that said Israel has decided to remove Yasser Arafat as somebody who's an obstacle to peace and somebody who incites terrorism, but will do so at a moment of our choosing. Well, since then, there have been subsequent bombings, and the Israeli right is asking the Prime Minister, why has Arafat not been removed? And the Israeli left is asking the Prime Minister, why did Israel attract all this international opprobrium and render Arafat very popular again among ordinary Palestinians, and then actually not do anything anyway? So we're all kind of baffled and mystified. Just the other day, Sharon said Israel's not going to kill Arafat, when one of his deputies had indicated that that was certainly one of the possibilities. I don't know what the government wants to do with Arafat. I know that I think most Israelis would like Yasser Arafat to fall down dead as soon as possible of natural causes without an Israeli anywhere within range, so that we won't be blamed for it. You know, one wants to wish people long life. But I don't think one feels that one wants to convey those wishes to somebody who has plainly been encouraging the murder of civilians. Arafat's a problem. Removing Arafat in any kind of dramatic way by Israel would I think the assessment is, be very counterproductive. It would unleash violence. It would discredit any potentially moderate successor. None of the options for handling Arafat are good, and that, I think, is why the Israeli government still doesn't quite know what to do about him.
The Sharon government is in the process of building a barrier that is supposed to basically wall out Palestinians from Israel so that there isn't a permeable area in which potential suicide bombers could cross over. One of the controversial things about this barrier is that it doesn't adhere to the border of the West Bank in Israel. It is twisting around Israeli settlements within the West Bank to protect the settlers. The development is despised among Palestinians in the West Bank. Is it controversial in Israel?
It's not hugely controversial in principle. And in principle, there is a wide support in Israel for anything that makes it harder for suicide bombers to get into Israel. And just, you know, to emphasize the tiny distances that we're talking about here, I drove very recently along what's called Road 6, which is a new road that extends along the eastern spine of Israel. And it runs all the way up to next to Tulkarem. Tulkarem is a West Bank Palestinian city, right on the Israel-West Bank border. And I then drove east to west across the whole width of Israel to Netanya, which is a coastal city. And the drive, in other words, from Israel's eastern sovereign border to Israel's western sovereign border, it's minutes. It took me 11 minutes to get from Tulkarem to the entrance to Netanya. And until this barrier started going up, that meant it was, you know, a 10-minute, 50-minute drive down the road for a bomber from Tulkarem to get to Netanya, as tragically several bombers did. So there's a huge amount of support, understandably in that context, I think, for anything that makes life harder for the bombers to enter Israel. But there's also big disagreement within Israel about how this barrier should extend. And even though it's being built, some of the route has not been finalized, and the arguments are continuing. It seems to me that the further east it runs, in other words, where it enters Palestinian territory, it becomes counterproductive, because you will then have, by definition, Palestinians on the supposedly safe side of your fence. So you're undermining the whole security imperative.
The whole idea of a wall is... you know, walls through history have a lot of really negative connotations, including the Warsaw Ghetto, East Berlin. What's some of the moral complexity of knowing that your government, your country, is, you know, responsible for erecting a wall?
Well, you see, first of all, I don't think that my government is responsible for erecting a wall. I think suicide bombers are responsible for my government erecting a wall. And again, you just need to look at very recent history. There was no big security barrier between Israel and the West Bank. There was no desire whatsoever on the part of the Sharon government to build any such barrier. By the way, I think barrier is a better term than wall. It is indeed a wall in some places where Palestinian residential areas come right up against the edge of sovereign Israel. In most places, it's a fence with patrol roads and so on. not wildly different to some borders in between countries in particularly tense areas. But none of this would have been going up if the bombers weren't coming to get us. The Sharon government, the last thing it wants to do is be building security barriers because it doesn't want any borders to be running along anything like the line that this fence is running along. It's being built to stop the bombers. So I'm very sorry, really, that ordinary people on the Palestinian side are going to suffer as a consequence of this barrier in areas where they are going to suffer. And I say again, the solution to all of this is stop the bombers and have a leadership that wants to stop the bombers and a public that tries to root out the bombers, because then we can settle down to peace talks and actually erect a mutually acceptable border along lines that both mainstream leaderships accept.
There is a peace plan that was written up by a group of Palestinians and Israelis in an unofficial capacity. These are not government representatives. Some of them have worked on previous peace agreements. Some of them have not. But this is meant to be a model, something that the official peace negotiators can look at and say, maybe we can borrow from this. What do you think are like the main couple of points of this peace plan, and what do you think of the peace plan? Do you think that this is something that could in fact be a model?
Well, I think that the imperative, the motivation for the negotiators to do this, part of it stems from the absence of proactive diplomatic policies by the Israeli government. As I think I've made clear, I certainly see terrorism as the root cause of the collapse, but I also think Israel has an absolute self-interest in encouraging Palestinian moderation and needs to signal that with the same resoluteness that it says we will fight terrorism as best as we can, that we seek peace as passionately as we can. And it needs to make clear that if the terrorism were to stop, Israel would be rushing back to the peace table. And I think that message perhaps is not said strongly enough by this government. And one of the reasons why I think these Geneva Accords have resonated as they have quite widely in Israel is because I think a lot of Israelis want to get the message across that they want to make peace and want to know whether there's anyone on the other side. There are elements of this accord that are problematic for most Israelis. For example, unlike at Camp David 3 years ago when the former Prime Minister, the Prime Minister at the time, Ehud Barak, said no to Palestinian demands for full Palestinian sovereignty at the Temple Mount, the holiest place in Judaism and site of the third holiest shrine in Islam, the Geneva Accords do award Palestinian sovereignty on the Temple Mount. I think most Israelis will be unhappy about that, to put it mildly. It seems that there is something of a breakthrough on the refugee issue, which is encouraging. It may be that in these model accords, the Palestinians are signaling a readiness to find a viable solution for the issue of Palestinian refugees that doesn't demographically overwhelm Jewish Israel. If that's the case, that's positive. It is claimed by the negotiators that these accords represent the first official Palestinian recognition or formal Palestinian recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. Now, reading the text, I don't think it quite says that. I think the Palestinian negotiators here are saying the Jews have a right to statehood. They don't say that Israel should be has the right to exist as a Jewish state. Now, if it sounds like I'm quibbling, these kinds of nuances are very, very important. The bottom line, though, is that this is a model accord. It's not binding on the Palestinian leadership. And I think there's a problem here in that you have an Israeli self-appointed negotiating team that is, albeit in a model accord, making concessions that most Israelis, at the moment at least, wouldn't agree to. And I fear that might make it harder for a legitimate Israeli government to make peace on better terms for Israel. I think you're going to have a Palestinian leadership that's going to say, well, in the Geneva Accords, you agreed to, and we want at least that, or we want better than that. And if that's the result, then of course it will have been the opposite of what these negotiators wanted. They may actually have made it harder for Israel to reach a viable agreement.
In the Geneva Accords, the right of return is dealt with, and what the Geneva Accord says is that Palestinians should have the right to move to the new Palestinian state, but they would not have the right to return to land that they once had within Israel. Raja Shahadeh, who I spoke with earlier, said that, and he's a Palestinian human rights lawyer, he said that plan would fall short for him. He thinks that there should be some kind of right of return, and not literally the right of all Palestinians to return, but the right of some to return to Israel, and then some kind of ratio for compensation for those who would have liked to return but cannot, or that wouldn't be allowed to. What would your reaction to that kind of ratio for compensation be?
Well, first of all, the notion of compensation, if he means financial compensation, I think is something that most Israelis would be very amenable to endorsing, the notion that people should be compensated financially. The notion of an unlimited number of Palestinians being given the option to come and live in Israel is something that most Israelis would reject because they think it would be used to overwhelm Israel by weight of numbers. Israel has 6.5 million people, 5 and a bit million Jews, 1 and a bit million Arabs, and the maximalist demand for a right of return is for 4 million plus Palestinians, and that, for Israelis who do the basic math, is tantamount to a call for Israel's destruction. So any kind of quote-unquote right that left open the possibility of millions of Palestinians coming into Israel will never be accepted by most Israelis or by an Israeli government. And I think most Israelis are probably so concerned about that issue and so bitter about Arafat's position on that issue that they would resist really even a much more limited entry of Palestinians into Israel. As far as most Israelis are concerned, Israel absorbed huge numbers of Jewish refugees from around the Middle East and North Africa and built a vibrant state on its part of mandatory Palestine, and the Palestinian leadership and those who spoke for it, rather than doing the same, rather than facing up to a division of territory that neither side was particularly happy about and building their own independent country and absorbing their own refugees, instead tried to destroy Israel and has relentlessly tried to destroy Israel ever since. And therefore, in Israel, there is a very, very, very wide misgiving about any kind of refugee, quote-unquote, right of return.
What about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank? This is always a sticking point in negotiations. And the question is, should Israel give up all of its settlements? Should it give up some of its settlements? How should those settlements be protected if they remain? Where do you think popular opinion is on that now?
Israeli popular opinion has always been and remains incredibly divided about the settlement issue. There are people who support the entire enterprise. There are people who believe that there should be limited settlement around Jerusalem and in areas where Israel is at its narrowest. There are parts of Israel where the country is 9 miles wide. And in those areas, perhaps some settlement adjoining what is today sovereign Israel would be vital in the conception of many Israelis. And there are many Israelis who oppose the whole settlement enterprise in total. It seems to me that Israel has failed itself in not trying to formulate a blueprint because, again, there is a consensus in Israel on the need for a territorial accommodation with the Palestinians. We don't think we can continue to maintain Israel as an overwhelmingly Jewish state and as a democracy unless we can find an accommodation with the Palestinians, and that by definition means relinquishing large parts of the West Bank, and settlements, if they're all over the West Bank, become a hugely complicating factor in any such agreement.
You've said that the way out of the situation that the Middle East is in and the way out of the new restrictions on the Palestinians is to stop the Palestinian bombings, the suicide bombings. Do you think that there's something that the Israeli government could alter in its political or military approach that would encourage Palestinians to stop the suicide bombings?
Look, I think that there are things that Israel can do to try and reach out to ordinary Palestinians over the heads of their leadership and tell them that we are waiting to embrace you at the peace table. We want to make peace. Most Israelis favor territorial separation from the Palestinians. I think the things that Israel can do are marginal, however. We can't fix this by ourselves. We have to have a leadership on the other side. I don't think most Israelis expect the Palestinian leadership to stop all acts of terrorism, but we are the absolute opposite of that situation. We have a Palestinian leadership whose most prominent public figure, Mr. Arafat, is actually encouraging people to carry out attacks. And you know that there are things that Israel can do to give a chance for moderation, but the key overwhelming responsibility and facility for changing things lies with the Palestinian leaders who the Palestinian public believe in and identify with, and they have to offer a different tone.
Is there a controversy in Israel over the morality of using helicopter gunships to go after militants and potential suicide bombers within the West Bank in civilian areas?
Look, there is dismay in Israel when, as a consequence of one or other of those attacks, civilians are killed. There was a case in Gaza, I think it was last year, when the Hamas commander in Gaza, Salah Shehadeh, was killed in one such attack. But 15, I think, Palestinians, innocent Palestinians, many of them children, were killed as well. And there was all hell to pay in terms of the Israeli internal debate and a great deal of condemnation within Israel. One of the factors that has so alienated moderate Israelis in terms of the Palestinian leadership is the very fact that we are being blown up everywhere. Because if the Palestinian goal was what they want you, me, and the rest of the world to believe, which is they want to liberate the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, then the last thing that they should be doing is attacking West Jerusalem and Haifa and Tel Aviv. Because what they're doing is they're telling Israelis, who, and many of whom may not be interested in holding on to those areas, many of whom would be very ready to relinquish those areas, they're telling them that that's not enough. It doesn't matter if you give up the West Bank and Gaza. We want it all. We're terrorizing all of Israel. And I think we assume, because it didn't happen, that Israel would survive 3 years of horrific terrorist onslaught. But I think the assumption may have been by those who fostered this campaign that they would destroy Israel. I mean, how would America have dealt with the proportional equivalent to 100-plus suicide bombings in our tiny country? I don't even know how sky-high a number that would mean in sort of equivalent terms for America. How would America have dealt with 100 suicide bombings, which is what we've had, with nowhere being off limits? What would people have demanded, and how would they have changed their actions, and would they have sought to flee to safer climes? So I think there was a very deliberate campaign launched here to terrorize all of Israel. And if Israelis believed this was only about the disputed territory, they'd probably be much less bitter and much less disillusioned about the Palestinian leadership. They believe, because they think that's what the bombers are telling us in bloody red letters day after day, that this is a campaign to terrorize all of Israel.
David Horovitz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Horovitz is the editor of the Israeli news magazine The Jerusalem Report and author of the forthcoming book Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror.